This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk with author Saidiya Hartman about her new book, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route.
This is one of the most moving narratives you'll ever hear. Saidiya walked through Ghana for 6 months, retracing the old slave routes.
We'll talk with representatives from the group Combatants for Peace.
Former Israeli combatants and former Palestinian combatants get together to try and forge peace in the Middle East.
Stay with us.
Welcome to Law and Disorder. This is Michael Ratner, president of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
I'm Michael Smith, New York City attorney and author.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
I'm Dahlia Hashad, director of the USA program at Amnesty International.
Here on Law and Disorder, we four lawyers and activists will strive to be your eyes and ears, your early warning system, your educators, counselors, and advocates. Here, we'll talk about the laws, practices, and procedures that we believe are strangling democracy. We'll be in the courts, in the books, on the streets, and here on the radio with you. We hope that we'll be lawyers you will like.
The great civil liberties attorney Bill Kunstler saw it coming. The police state is emerging, he warned. It's coming piece by piece, before and especially after September 11th.
Recently, we did a segment on Law and Disorder on the case of Dr. Sami Amin Al-Aryan and a film that is being showed to raise awareness of his case. 1 week ago today, there was a disturbing development in this case. We learned that Dr. Al-Aryan was called before a third grand jury, despite the fact that he had signed what is called a no-cooperation agreement with the government, and that provided that he wouldn't have to appear before any grand jury. The announcement came a week ago, literally 1 month before he was scheduled to be released. He's been in prison the past 4 years, despite a jury's failure to return one single guilty verdict against him. National Lawyers Guild former President Peter Erlander is Al-Aryan's counsel in the Fourth Circuit and the Eleventh Circuit in appeals, and was quoted in a press release that the Guild issued last week saying, "The duplicity of the Justice Department and the failure of the courts to recognize basic contract law principles in this case is an example of how politically motivated so-called war on terror prosecutions are distorting the American legal system. In the Al-Aryan case, the Justice Department and the courts have made a mockery of the Sixth Amendment right to a jury trial, which should outrage all Americans as deeply as the Tampa jury that acquitted Dr. Al-Aryan more than 2 years ago." What does this mean for Dr. Al-Aryan? It's likely, when he refuses to testify, which he will, because of the no-cooperation agreement, he will be charged with obstruction of justice. This could mean that he will receive several additional years in prison. Just as a bit of background for listeners, when Dr. Al-Aryan was arrested back in February 2003, he was a prominent Palestinian academic and a leading member of the Muslim community in South Florida. He was acquitted on 8 of 17 charges against him in December 2005 after a six-month trial with three co-defendants. In April 2006, he pleaded guilty to a single count of conspiracy that involved assisting his brother-in-law in his immigration matters and denying to a reporter that he knew of a colleague's association with Palestinian Islamic Jihad. In return, federal prosecutors agreed to drop the remaining eight charges, on which the jury had hung 10-2 for acquittal, and to recommend a time-served sentence with release and deportation in May 2006. On the record, the Tampa Assistant United States Attorney admitted that the usual cooperation clause was removed from the plea agreement because Dr. Al-Aryan and his lawyers said they would not agree to any form of cooperation. Then, on May 1, 2007, a Tampa federal judge gave Al-Aryan the constitutional maximum sentence of one additional year, citing the very offenses that the jury had acquitted him of. So despite the no cooperation agreement, and while the jury of his acquitted conduct sentence was pending, Al-Aryan was found in civil contempt on January 2007. In December 2007,
11 months later, a federal judge lifted the civil contempt charge, and El-Aryan's new release was to be in a couple of weeks, April 2008. After the contempt detention, El-Aryan went on a 100-day hunger strike because of the government's refusal to honor the plea agreement. And last week, we've learned he has just begun another hunger strike. Before trial, El-Aryan had been held in a supermax solitary confinement and was subjected to inhumane and punitive conditions, including 23-hour lockdown, abuse from prison staff, unsanitary conditions with exposure to vermin, denial of adequate winter clothing, bedding, and religiously appropriate diet. All of these breach Article 10 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, to which the U.S. is a party. And it's triggered an ongoing investigation by the Department of Justice Inspector General. This latest decision to call El-Aryan before a grand jury clearly breaches his plea agreement with the government, and a highly political maneuver to lengthen his already too long prison term. We'll keep you updated on this case in future episodes of Law and Disorder. Today we talk with author Saidiya Hartman about her new book, Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route. Hartman returns to Ghana and takes the reader with her to gain another perspective on one of the oldest and deepest divides in America, slavery. Saidiya Hartman is an expert on the African slave trade. She chose Ghana because it was the center for the slave trade with several key ports. Every man, woman, and child is measured against quantities of tobacco, sugar, coffee, copper pots, or brass bracelets. Reviews have described Lose Your Mother as a travel memoir on the surface, but deeper in the thought-provoking chapters are angry meditations on slavery and its legacy. Welcome, Saidiya, to Law and Disorder.
It's great to be here.
Well, Saidiya, we've all loved your book completely, and it's one of the, really a moving journey. Book called Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route. But first of all, tell us, what does it even mean, Lose Your Mother?
Well, Lose Your Mother goes to the core of what it means to be a slave. The most universal definition of the slave is a stranger, someone who's cut off from kin, country, and past. So Lose Your Mother encapsulates that. When I was in Ghana on my second trip, these young boys gave me letters, and in the letters, every letter ended with, "You lose your mother. You descendants of Africa who live on the other side of the Atlantic have lost your mother because of the slave trade." There are also all these popular stories in West Africa about how those who were enslaved were made to forget their past. And there's a great story about a medicine that was used to make captives forget their past, and that medicine was called Mantaua, which means forget mother. So it was just so resonant also with all the kind of songs that predominate in an African-American experience, like, I feel like a motherless child. So it echoes that essential chord of homelessness and alienation and exile.
In fact, when you got off the plane in Accra, you said people called you stranger. They used... Is the Swahili word for stranger, or
no,
I'm not sure what it was. Oh, but I can't pronounce it. But
it's an Akan word for stranger, and it doesn't only mean stranger; it means white stranger. So the word is Obruni. So obviously, I was taken aback to return to my motherland, only to be called a white person. You know,
right.
People joke African American expats in Ghana that they heard the word Obruni so many times that they thought it meant welcome. And then only months later do they, find out that it's actually a word that marks them as someone who's an outsider.
Let's tell people about this trip. You went to Ghana. Why did you go? What did you, just give us a sort of broad outline.
Well, I had written a previous book on slavery called Scenes of Subjection, and that book was about slavery in a U.S. context, slavery and its aftermath. And I was really interested in thinking about slavery in a comparative framework and thinking about what are those different legacies of slavery. So I went to Ghana the first time just to see the forts and castles, because Ghana has more forts and castles that were built in the context of the slave trade than any other place in West Africa. And I was surprised by the very different stories people told about that past, the very different relationship to the Atlantic slave trade. So I went home and immediately applied for a Fulbright, and then I returned the following year as a Fulbright scholar.
That was 1997.
97 to 98.
And how long did you spend there?
10 months.
How did the process change you?
Oh, God, that's a great question. I mean, I think that if I went to Ghana with a sense of myself as an African American, and by that, I meant a certain conception of the black world, and that black world being shaped by this experience of Atlantic slavery, and that we had a common understanding of that. And also my African-American identity fundamentally shaped by Pan-Africanism, that in the course of the year, that identity, I feel like it was torn apart and refashioned. And I think that that refashioning was productive because it forced me to think about a lot of difficult issues. But the unanimity that I had assumed didn't in fact exist, and in part because of the complexities of the slave trade. So even though I'd always considered myself generally a kind of post-Marxist, the importance of really dynamics of class and exploitation in the Atlantic slave trade, particularly when we look about the African role in the Atlantic slave trade, is absolutely essential. So on that side of it, the central division isn't a racial division as it is in the Americas, but it's really a division of class. It's really a division of powerful states and decentralized social groups.
I thought that was completely amazing. I mean, I guess this is a sort of gross impression of it from a person who just read your book, but you went really with the idea that going back to a motherland and is sort of, you said, a Pan-African, as you said, many different narratives came up. The narrative that people didn't want to know about or think about was the slave narrative. Their narratives were very different. So can you discuss some of the narratives that you saw or that you heard or you came to?
Those narratives changed depending upon where I was in Ghana. And on the coast, basically, many of the coastal people were middlemen in the trade. Their wealth and fortune was kind of allied with the slave trade. And, you know, as is the case in the U.S., elites also control the production of historical knowledge. So basically, the story about the Atlantic slave trade that was hegemonic was, oh, well, some of us, you know, sort of distantly participated in this European trade, but it was both basically a kind of European thing. But then when we look at really important great states like Asante and you know, the glories of the Ashanti Kingdom, you know, is at the core of a certain kind of Afrocentric pride. So to then discover that the wealth and power of Asante was built, you know, in tandem with the spread of the slave trade, and that Asante as this kind of warrior empire was key in kind of capturing people, you know, deporting them off the coast. But when you go farther inland, those people experienced the slave trade, as did most Africans experience the slave trade, as its victims or as its potential victims. So again, when we think of the people who were partners, they were an elite minority. And I often say to even describe it as a trade is so inaccurate. It would be as if, you know, our view of the war in Iraq was shaped by that of like oil merchants, right? You know, so it wasn't actually a slave trade. It was war and theft and death and imprisonment for the majority of the people who were captured. And then it just created immense social insecurity for others and disrupted farming and all the kind of the core essentials of social life.
Your last chapter I thought was really interesting on that, because you go to a village whose name I can't pronounce, Gualu or something?
Gualu.
Yeah. And you talk about how those people were people who had to flee and go onto the savannah and built a wall to try and protect themselves. And their narrative is one of, pleased might be too strong a word, but that they escaped slavery, that they made it through, and that's their narrative, and you were coming there as someone who didn't, and putting those together. And you were able at the end of the book put them together with a little child's song, but why don't you talk about that for a minute?
I mean, it was interesting because as I made my journey, I was looking for stories of the enslaved, stories of the captives, and there are so few stories that remain. I mean, if by conservative estimates 11 to 12 million Africans arrived in the Americas, then we only have a handful of narratives for that experience. And one of the central narratives, Aletta Equiano's narrative, is now in dispute. Mm-hmm. So it's an experience.
Oh, you didn't know that? Yeah, Adam Hochschild talks about that in his book, right?
That's largely unrepresented.
They're not sure he was true about it or something.
Now there's questions as to whether Ekiano was actually Nigerian or whether he was from South Carolina.
Oh, no.
So it's an experience that's largely unrepresented. So then to make my way to a community.
You should just say that book sold during the – it sold – it was a huge bestseller. I mean, tell our listeners what that book is, Ekiano's.
A lot of Ekiano's interesting narrative was incredibly important in the context of the abolitionist movement, precisely because it was a firsthand account of someone who had experienced captivity, the terrors of the Middle Passage, who purchased his own freedom, and then became a political activist. He was a member of a social organization called Sons of Africa, and he was also really central in publicizing the Zong case, where Luke Collingwood threw 132 Africans overboard into the Atlantic in order to collect the insurance. So Ekiano's narrative is the central narrative for representing this experience, and one scholar has questioned the authenticity of the narrative because in two documents, a muster roll and a baptismal certificate, Olada Ekiano says he's from South Carolina. He was he worked at sea, much of the time, so there may have been reasons why he would have chosen to identify himself from South Carolina at some point rather than from Nigeria because the slave trade was still active and open. But I hear that there's a team of Nigerian scholars. They're not going to let Ekiano go.
But you brought it together in the end, at the end of the book. You were able to put the narrative of the fugitives and the Sisala people, really. We come together with your own slave narrative.
Right, because I think that when I was on my journey and I realized at the end that I was looking for perhaps a memory of slavery or a story of slavery that resembled my own. And their story was very different. I mean, it's not unlike the very different kinds of stories people in Ireland or those in the diaspora tell about the famine. Everyone who remained in Ireland, the story is a miraculous story of surviving the worst. And those in the diaspora tend to remember the atrocity and the death. And for the Sisala, what they remember is their triumph, their battle, their struggle in repelling raiders, even though people were captured and even though people were lost. And I think that that was what struck me. And more than that, that it was actually the struggle for freedom and that practice of freedom, more than a common narrative about the past, that was the bridge between us and actually the narrative that seemed capable of producing a different kind of future. The stories we tell about the past are always predicated and determined by our present.
That's a great part of this book, actually. I learned so much from just reading how you look at your past by the present. I thought you really did a great job on that.
I was struck by the relations you had with other African-American expatriates over there.
I mean, Ghana is central for two reasons, and you put your hand on one, and that is it's the heart of Pan-Africanism, and it was the heart of the Pan-Africanist dream. I mean, ever since Kwame Nkrumah became the first leader of an independent state in sub-Saharan Africa, Ghana has exercised its call, and literally Nkrumah invited those from the diaspora to come, help us not only build a free country here, but help us build a free world. I mean, it was this really incredibly capacious black radical internationalism. And so entering Ghana in the kind of the wake of that dream was also one of the freedom narratives that I had to grapple with, too. When I was there, it was the 40th anniversary of independence, and people were calling into popular radio shows and saying, were we actually better off under colonialism than we are now? And so in some sense, the theme of freedom dreams that were yet to be actualized had everything to do with a post-colonial present as well. This idea that the world should have been remade, but it wasn't exactly remade. And it seemed that that, too, was something that connected me. I mean, I cite a speech by Amilcar Cabral when he comes to Harlem and he's speaking to an audience of black supporters. And he says, there's actually a language that's better than that of brothers and sisters. And it's the language of political allies and comrades. And I think that that was the connection that I was trying to make in the book. Like, yes, I am a stranger. You know, I'm a New Yorker. I was born in Brooklyn. I'm not culturally African at all. There's a history that's produced the modern world that we're all inhabiting. But what's the basis of that connections? And it seems that what was vital about that Pan-Africanism of the 50s is that it was a dream of connection and commonality that was at its core political, right?
I can say on behalf of all of us that was our reaction to your book, that we've met a comrade. Mm-hmm. And I just want to repeat for our listeners, they should run to the bookstore and
It's
now out in paperback. Lose Your Mother, A Journey Along the Atlantic Slave Route. This is just a spectacular book. We all read a lot, but we haven't read a book like this in quite a long time.
I learned a lot from this, and I've learned a lot over the last year in thinking about this issue. But when you said, I too live in the time of slavery, and then you talk about arguments you had with your brother and discussions about the state of Black America, really, in a certain way. I'd like you to read some, talk about that, and then maybe read the passage, if that's the one you choose to read.
Okay. I'm going to read from a chapter entitled So Many Dungeons. And in this chapter, I'm really wrestling with the connections between the past and the present. I, too, live in the time of slavery, by which I mean I am living in the future created by it. It is the ongoing crisis of citizenship. Questions first posed in 1773 about the disparity between the sublime ideal of freedom and the facts of blackness are uncannily relevant today. The echoes could be heard in a plea, still waiting for an answer, chalked onto a rooftop in the Ninth Ward of New Orleans. Help, the water is rising, please. 6 people are trapped on the roof, and 2 of them are waving American flags, hoping against the odds that the stars and stripes might make their plight visible, keep them afloat, and demonstrate unequivocally, we are citizens too. But the anxiety and the doubt fueling the assertion was made plain by the photograph's caption, cast away. History doesn't unfold with one error bound to and determining the next in an unbroken chain of causality. It is without providence or final cause, writes Foucault. There is only the iron hand of necessity shaking the dice box of chance. So the point isn't the impossibility of escaping the stranglehold of the past, or that history is a succession of uninterrupted defeats, or that the virulence and tenacity of racism is inexorable, but rather that the perilous conditions of the present establish the link between our age and a previous one in which freedom, too, was yet to be realized. The past is neither inert nor given. The stories we tell about what happened then, the correspondence we discern between today and times past, and the ethical and political stakes of these stories redound in the present. If slavery feels proximate rather than remote, and freedom seems increasingly elusive, this has everything to do with our own dark times. If the ghost of slavery still haunts our present, it is because we are still looking for an exit from the prison.
That's beautifully said.
Yeah.
It relates in some way to your conversations with your brother, the line about I too live in the time of slavery, and you're wanting to try and look at that past and him saying it's in the past. That's the way I took it in a broad way. But
yeah, and I mean, I guess, what is slavery and when did it end? And I think, you know, what exactly did the 13th Amendment disestablish? Was it only property in slaves? Was it a form of commodity production based upon death and intense exploitation? Was it second-class citizenship? So I think that how we understand slavery and its legacy also depends upon how we understand slavery. Many people understand slavery as being defined in the most kind of narrow legal way. Well, property in slaves is now abolished. Well, involuntary servitude hasn't been abolished. Disposable life hasn't been abolished. The kind of system of commodity production generated by the Atlantic slave trade hasn't been abolished. So aren't we all still living in the global order in which that is structuring our present? So that was the more capacious definition of slavery that I wanted to consider, because that also connects us to all these other histories. I mean, there were 4 continents involved in the slave trade. There unfortunately, tragically, new and emergent forms of slavery that are appearing everywhere. So I wanted my book, while not directly speaking to those issues, to echo and resound with those concerns as well.
I understood it, but I also took it much more literally. And when I read it to my daughter, who's 17, and she says, well, what does that mean? And I said, well, look around you. Where do we live? Who's around us? Who do you see pushing white children in baby carriages? Who do you see going to your school? And I just gave her all these examples in which basically I looked at that as legacy isn't the right word, but that we're too living in a time of slavery. And I think obviously African Americans have known that forever. Whites know it less so. And I think that your book at least got me really thinking along those lines in a much more, in a very literal sense, when I had to talk to my daughter.
And I mean, I have that experience. Sometimes I'm in Central Park and I see the worlds of nanny and children, and I can be in Bridgetown, you know, Barbados in, at the end of the 18th century, right, because of the relationships of kind of employer and servant are so racialized. So,
and right. out of that experience,
or just the resonance of, you know, the prison house of race, but the literal prison, you know, that we're exporting globally, right? So that there's a way that empire also extends its own logic of race and racism to the world.
Saidiya Hartman, I read in the paper Bush had embarked on his trip to Ghana, actually, and the irony of that, you know, knowing what we know about Bush. And in fact, I learned also today that a great-great-great-great-grandfather of his in Maryland was actually a slave owner and a slave dealer.
Well, somehow I'm not surprised that there was a slave trader in his past. You know, it's a question about what role is Africa going to play in the world, and will it continue, you know, to play this role of being a place where its resources are extracted to give people a kind of, you know, a wage that's not even livable? Will it just be a kind of part of the extended backyard of U.S. empire as it kind of makes its plans for the world? I don't know. I mean, I'm not necessarily hopeful about Bush's visit to Ghana. I mean, I think that the again, a Pan-Africanist tradition in Ghana represented by Nkrumah, and that in some sense Rawlings also tried to resuscitate. And I think that President Kufuor is much more open and amenable to kind of economic strategies of neoliberalism and all of those things. So I think that whether that's a path to development, you know, for me is highly in doubt. But
I think we can be more certain about that.
How do you follow a masterpiece such as this? Do you have plans for another book?
You know, I do have plans for another book. In writing the book, I did what was required to write it, and that meant having to visit these incredibly dark spaces, whether, you know, visiting the slave dungeon, and I don't, maybe I went to the slave dungeon in Ghana 20 or 30 times, I don't know.
Is that the one that's called Elmina?
Elmina and Cape Coast.
Or Cape Coast. Right.
But they're, you know, over.
All over.
Yeah, they're all over. Or the story about the 13-year-old girl who's murdered aboard the slave ship. But when I finished the book, I was just overwhelmed with a kind of grief and sadness. And I thought, well, you know, I don't want to write another book about slavery, so I'm actually working on a new project that's about reconstruction, which for me was a moment of revolutionary possibility. So that's what my next book project is about.
I went to see they're having an auction of African American printed matter, actually, and I read they had material from a person named Blanche Bruce, who you must have heard of. Mm-hmm. He was a senator from, where was it, Louisiana?
Louisiana.
He was a senator for 10 years or so, or a number of years, and then, of course, they put an end to Reconstruction, eliminated every vestige of a African-American having any political power at all. So it's certainly in a crucial period, because you had this small window.
Yeah.
And then, boom, in fact, your own experience is reflected in that. In your book, you talk about visiting land that was owned by your family in Alabama, was it?
Yes.
Right. So why don't you just tell us about that? Because it does relate to the whole way in which you talk about the issue of slavery in the book.
Well, it's interesting when we think about, like, the vision of freedom, and there's a notion of freedom as, you know, well, simply the abolition of property in slaves, right? But for the formerly enslaved, their notion of freedom was fundamentally defined by economic self-sufficiency. So that's why, you know, the language of 40 acres and a mule. to be landless for my great-grandfather was to be a slave, to not be able to control your economic life or those of your kind of like family and community. And I think that when we look in the 19th century, even more than the language of rights, that language of economic sufficiency was really important, so that there was a proto-socialist conception of collective notions of freedom and economic autonomy. In the book, I tell the story of my great-grandfather telling me the story about slavery, but it began with him driving through the countryside and looking at all of these farms that were owned by agribusiness. And we know that even since 1960, the incredible loss of land by black farmers has been enormous, so that there was these signs in the present that were bringing him back to the past. And that's how my own interest in slavery began, with him telling me those stories.
Now, I thought that was an amazing part of the book, of that ride you took through and him showing you the land. And of course, then him talking about his mother, who was born a slave, and the day of her freedom, when a man on a horse from the Union side came over and said to her, she was 10 years old, I think?
Yeah.
And said, you're free.
Yeah, I mean, so powerful and yet so abbreviated. So my great-grandfather, you know, the little that he knew, he tried to make sure that all of his children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren knew. But again, there are these traces and fragments of a past. And, you know, I was 12 at the time. Even then, I was struck by the preciousness of those details, that he couldn't actually tell more than, and yes, she had been freed. And
we totally identify with you. Heidi is half Armenian. Michael's family comes from Poland. Mine comes from Poland and Hungary. And all of us have only those fragments as well. All of us kind of grew up between two cultures. And
one difference I want to tell you, though, when you read the book, it's a big difference. And this talks about the book and what you expected to find in Ghana. You could trace your family back to, I think it was the mid-18th century, you said?
Yes.
1750. Mm-hmm. I may not be able to go much farther back, but I can probably go back a little farther. But yours really stops.
The beginning of the 19th century, 1820.
1820 it is. Mm-hmm. So it's the mid-19th. Yeah. Right. So you really stop in 1820. Mm-hmm. This idea, I mean, once you're on the boat, that's the end.
No, it was totally different in that respect.
Part of what the book is about is trying to, I mean, it's not the Alex Haley look for roots, because you specifically knew that wasn't going to happen.
No, one, it wasn't the Alex Haley roots story, because I wasn't trying to recreate my own personal family narrative. What I wanted to do was to claim, and actually to have all of us claim, those people who we'll never be able to name, right? All of those who are anonymous, all of the unceremoniously buried. So in that sense, it was a search on the trail of commoners rather than the search for my own personal kin. And I think that there's something that can be incredibly recuperative and dangerous about wanting to reconstitute those family stories, or, oh, okay, I can, you know, locate my origins in a kind of remote village in the northern hinterland. I mean, one, I think it creates this really static, ahistorical notion of Africa, like those people have always been there. But I wanted to have the reader contend with the irreparable violence of the Atlantic slave trade and everything that's been lost, and those names and those cultures and those identities have disappeared, and that's irreparable, and that's part of the violence that we have to live with.
Saidiya Hartman, you've written Lose Your Mother and thought so deeply and brilliantly about what that all means. But looking forward, what do we do next? How do we get out of prison of history that the slave trade has brought to African Americans and to really all Americans? What do you think of reparations?
I would say that I'm for reconstruction, and that vision of reconstruction encompasses reparation, because part of what reconstruction would entail would be a redistribution of wealth from the top to the rest of us. And I think that that's what many kind of people who are advocating for reparations are actually struggling for. I would also say that that vision of kind of redressing the injuries of a past is the end of poverty, the end of imperialist wars, notions of universal citizenship, right? I mean, and that's why a language of the fugitive and the stateless is so predominant also in the book, because I think that I, in the context of African American, for most of our history here, African Americans in a way have been stateless people, that they have not been represented by a government, even as they've been considered, you know, citizens, more or less kind of second class citizens. So I think that some of those things would go a long way towards redressing, you know, the injuries of slavery. And I think it's also a vision of a social world in the aftermath of capitalism, right? That there's a legal theorist, you know, Anthony Farley, he says that basically the slave is the apogee of the commodity. The slave is the commodity in flesh, right? So that what it, again, would then mean to redress that would be to think about something that's an alternative to capitalist commodity production. So those are some of the wild dreams, those fugitive dreams that I entertain. And I think that there are many people around the globe who are entertaining the same kinds of dreams.
Certainly, yeah. All three of us. It's just been a great privilege to have you on Law and Disorder.
It's a really rich book for people. I mean, I didn't even get to like a half of it. I mean, there was all these jokes that her African friends would tell on her as a descendant of slaves. I mean, there's stuff in the book that is remarkable, and really remarkable about her dealing with that as a African American in an Africa that at first didn't seem very accepting, I would say. But it's really great, and it's one of the most moving books I think that I've read in many, many years.
Thank you.
Really.
Thank you, Saidiya.
Here on Law and Disorder, we've had a number of shows discussing the deepening crisis between Israel and Palestine. We've spoken with a number of people, including Joel Covell, author of Overcoming Zionism, Creating a Single Democratic State in Palestine. Today we're joined by Israeli and Palestinian peace activists Jonathan Shapira and Bassam Aramin, both members of a group called Combatants for Peace that is made up of former fighters from both Israel and the occupied territories. We'll also update you on the Israeli court case to reopen the investigation of the death of Aber Aramin, Bassam's 10-year-old daughter. The investigation had been previously closed for lack of evidence. Shapira is a former elite commando with the Israeli military. Aramin was an armed member of Fatah and spent 7 years in an Israeli prison. His daughter, Aber, was shot dead by an Israeli soldier last year. We're also joined by Donna Baranski-Walker, Executive Director of Rebuilding Alliance, that is partnering with Combatants for Peace.
Jonathan Shapira, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much.
First, we'd like to start, what is Combatants for Peace?
Who wants to start? Jonathan, Bassam?
I'll start because I am from Palestine.
Good.
Combatants for Peace is a jointly Palestinian and Israeli organization. We established it in 2005. By four Palestinian and seven Israelis. They are from the same people who used to kill one each other from the past. They are the fighters, ex-fighters. The Israeli part is ex-soldiers who served in the occupied territories and practiced the occupation on the Palestinian side. And they discovered that they don't add anything to the Israeli security, to don't protect any Israelis. They just create more violence and more acts in the Palestinian side. And the Palestinian side, who people who spend many years from their life in the Israeli jails, like me when I spent 7 years when I was 17 years old, we reached the point that this conflict cannot be solved in a military solution. The fact that more than 6 years we are fighting one each other, and the result is more killing, more suffering, more civilians suffering, and Israel is not safe, Palestine is not free, and we replace our weapons with our voices, and we think that the most effective weapon against this kind of occupation is nonviolent struggle, jointly Palestinian and Israel together against the occupation. We consider ourselves unique people, strength people, moral and courage people, because we are, during the battle, during the war, we are replace our weapon by talking and discussions peace.
Jonathan Shapira, can you give us an idea of what led you personally, what were your experiences that brought you to be a member of Combatants for Peace?
Yeah, it's a long story, but I have to summarize it in few sentences. I think I was brought up in a very Zionist and very patriotic family society. And what happened to me later, after I became a pilot, I flew Black Hawk and helicopters in the SDA Air Force, I understood that something here is completely wrong. I want to protect my people. I want to protect my country. But I'm just contributing to the opposite thing. And especially the assassinations that were starting to be the only policy of the Israeli government. They sent pilots to assassinate Palestinian suspects. I was not asked to shoot anyone myself. I flew mostly rescue missions and then the command soldiers. But I understood that it doesn't matter if I do it myself or I'm just supporting a mission or I'm just bringing soldiers to conquest someone or to demolish a house or to assassinate someone. Once I'm part of this system, I have responsibility. And I understood that I'm part of this circle of revenge, circle of bloodshed. I think it happened around 4 or 5 years ago when I understood that the Palestinian cannot be my enemy. People who are struggling for freedom, people who are struggling for liberation, for justice, for equality, are people who are struggling for the same principle and ideals that I believe in. So how can they be my enemy? And we found out that we have a common enemy, Israelis and Palestinians, and our common enemy is the occupation and the oppression and the injustice. And once you understand this very, very important focal idea, you have to reevaluate and to change your way of life in a way. And the first thing is to refuse to participate in illegal and immoral activity of the Israeli army and the Israeli Air Force. But the second thing, and maybe more important, is to join forces with your ex-enemy and to struggle together. And in a way, we say that we Israelis are now joining the non-violent Palestinian struggle for liberation, and the Palestinians are joining our non-violent struggle for liberating ourselves from being oppressors, from leading this self-destructive policy.
We're speaking with people from Combatants for Peace. Bassam, what's been the reaction among Palestinians to your taking this position, and among Israelis, if you are aware of that? And the same question really for Jonathan.
Yeah, it's a very good question, but the fact that I accept the idea to meet an ex-Israeli soldiers, I know that the majority will accept that from the Palestinian ex-fighters. This is the reality. They encourage us, they respect us. Even after I lost my 10-year-old daughter, Abir, on 16th of January 2007, when one Israeli soldier shot and killed her, I asked them for justice, not for revenge. They respect me more. They know that we are people not here for because we have some sadness or a crisis in our life, because we are serious people. We believe in what we are doing, and we live it. We are together. They encourage us, actually, and as I told, we are fighters. We fight for those people. We have our right to speak, and they must hear us. It's a good reaction, and we have supported from also the President Mahmoud Abbas and the Palestinian government and the General Jabrin Erjoub. Yeah, I can say that they support us and encourage us.
Well, thank you. And Jonathan, what's been the reaction among Israelis to your actions?
Yeah, you can imagine that the Israeli government doesn't like us so much. Basically, we are talking about truth, about what we believe is the ongoing reality on the ground, and they are trying to cover it up and continue to lie to the world and lie to the Israeli society itself. when we are saying that these are actions that are immoral and illegal and war crimes, and it's counterproductive to any legitimate goal that you can think about, they don't like us so much. But many people, and I'm talking about many people in the Israeli society, consider us as, you know, being heroes of, you know, the current struggle for justice and for peace. Of course, many other people believe that we are, you know, traitors and all this kind of stuff that you always have when you have a society that is a fear-striking society, people that are being controlled by their fears and by their Holocaust syndromes and many other reasons that we can explain, you know, the ongoing situation in my society. But I can just give you two positive examples of how, for example, once with my friends declared that we are going to refuse to participate in these illegal and immoral missions. It was 4 years ago in 2003. The first phone call I made was to my squadron commander. My squadron commander said to me that he admires my courage and he supports me in any way, but if he will be asked to discharge me, dismiss me from the Air Force, he will have to do that. Another example is the two sons of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert. Two of them are refusing to serve in the occupied territories. His two sons are refusers. His daughter is demonstrating with us and with the Israeli anti-occupation activists in front of the Chief of Staff House. If they are completely supportive of this struggle, if they are completely against what their father is leading, I think we still have hope, and many people should join our struggle and the son and daughters of Prime Minister Olmert.
Well, we totally agree with you. Heidi?
You mentioned that your daughter was killed. Yeah. How old was she, and what were the circumstances?
Yeah, actually, in a normal day, in a sunny day, she, after she finished her examination in mathematics, she go outside the school with her daughter, with her sister, Arin. It was an Israeli jeep for border police, and they shot her. Like, this is what happened exactly. And we have 14 Palestinian witnesses that they shot her in her back from a distance of 15 meters by a rubber, American rubber bullet from American M16, from American jeep, from a soldier. Maybe he have training in America. This is what happened for Abir, and like more than 971 Palestinian kids have been killed since 2000, and no one guilty, no suspect.
Was she in Jerusalem at the time?
Yeah, actually, it's in Anata, East Jerusalem, and even Abir have Israeli ID, but she is a Palestinian. It's a very clear discrimination, very clear racism against the Palestinians. They opened investigation after 3 days, and they was in the location of the crime after 5 days. They closed the file after 3 months and closed it again after 7 months, and they refused our appeal before 10 days exactly. We will.
Even though there were witnesses?
Yeah, we have 14 Palestinian witnesses, and they don't look at them. They consider that they haven't any evidence that they involved in this incident. As I told, more than 971 Palestinian kids without any guilty, without any investigation. But in this case, I determined to bring this killer to the justice because my little daughter wasn't a fighter. She don't belong to Fatah or to Hamas. She was just a child.
Yes, and an innocent child.
To kill my daughter, I want to bring him to the justice.
Donna, could you tell us a bit how you got involved in partnering with Combatants for Peace and what you do?
I'm the director of the Rebuilding Alliance, a group, an American nonprofit that is rebuilding communities and making them safe, rebuilding communities in war zones, areas of occupation. We were the group that helped rebuild the home that for the family Rachel Corey had stood to protect in Gaza. And we've been doing other projects like that, home reconstruction, building schools and kindergartens throughout the West Bank and in East Jerusalem, in addition to Gaza. When Abir Armin was killed, there was an international appeal, a condolence book that was put together by women of a certain age who are based in New York. And I was one of the people who signed the condolence book. And as I was signing, I just thought there had to be something more something more that we could do than be so sorry and so saddened by tragic loss of a little child killed by a rubber bullet. And my board of directors said, go ahead, call the Aramin family, see if they need help, maybe funeral expenses, maybe something that people could help them with. And when I called Bassam, he said that the family asked for nothing for themselves, but they wanted a way to help Abir's classmates who have to face her empty chair and desk in her classroom, that they have experienced this trauma so personally and devastatingly themselves, that we needed a way to help them. So we all set together to work together, Combatants for Peace, Rebuilding Alliance, the Aramin family, and created a wonderful design for a garden, a beer's garden, a safe place to grow, a playground in its first phase, fruit trees and olive trees in the next phase, and a memorial fountain, artists helping out at the school, ways that the children could benefit directly. So I'm really delighted to tell you that just a week ago, there was the opening ceremony. The Combatants for Peace were there building the playground and then returned. They came from all over the West Bank, all over Israel, to hold the memorial ceremony and open the first phase, the playground at the school.
Great.
And I also was coordinating the speaking tour that brought the Aramins to the U.S., along with Yonatan Shapira and Elik Elhanan, and speaking to Americans and visiting the State Department, Congress, trying to tell everyone the story and ask for their help in pursuing justice for Abir Aramin.
And what kind of response did you get on that speaking tour in the U.S.?
I think it was really positive. The people who heard us speak were moved deeply by each person's story. They learned about this approach that Combatants for Peace uses in confronting one another by listening to each other. And they learned how scary it was in the beginning and then how the group has persisted and grown. People kept saying, I wish I brought five more friends. I need to do more about this. Activists throughout the country are ready to hear what's happened next with the case and putting together a file that can describe it in detail, because our next step, because of it being dismissed in the Israeli courts, we really need everyone's help to push it forward with their elected representatives here.
You know, that would be very helpful. On our website, we could post that information on the case if you can send it to us when it's ready.
Bassam, just one question. We have a couple more minutes, and then one for Yonatan. Sort of leave us with what your last thoughts are. Maybe Michael has another question, but give me a sense of the size, and has Combatants for Peace grown? Where are you now in terms of size?
Yeah, in size, actually, we are now more than 450 people. Every day we are growing.
Congratulations.
We have new members. Every day we have new people who want to join us. But we still, it's a small number, but the idea is great. The idea is huge. And this is our power.
Bassam, anything you want to raise that we haven't raised with you yet?
Yeah, they can visit our website, combatantsforpeace.org. And I want to, all the world to know that there is, I want to prove that there is a difference between violence and revenge and justice. When we ask for justice, all the world must support us, all the just lovers must support us, and the fact that we are together, the Israelis and the Palestinians, the same people who used to kill one each other, if we can sit and talk, and everyone can talk.
And Yonatan, did you have something you wanted to say in closing?
Yeah, just a few things. I think that it's hard to say, but I feel uncomfortable, but we have to admit that the justice system in my country, in Israel, is not working when it comes to people who are not Jewish. There are some positive examples, but all in all, when you're not Jewish, when you're not Israeli, the justice system is not working for you. We are intending to use this case, to take this symbol in a case of Abir Aramin, who was killed, simply killed, without any reason, and to bring it to the international community and to bring it to the American people as well, trying to prove to the world and to ourselves that a non-violent way can bring justice. It's kind of a test case for us to see if we can bring justice the case of Bir Amin, maybe we have hope to bring justice in the larger picture and in whole horrible situation. And maybe with the help of people here in the States and in other places, we can somehow bring justice, and we are completely committed to this kind of struggle. The last thing I want to say is to the Jewish audience and to the Jewish community here in the States, and we talk to Jewish people in synagogues and in Jewish community centers and in many other places, and many of the activists that are helping us here are Jewish, but there is a problem, and we have to speak about it loudly, that many people in this community here are living with double standards. There are four beautiful values and ideals and principles of peace, equality, freedom, but when it comes to Israel and Palestine, something is not continuing to work, and we have to wake these people up. And if you like your families, if you like your Jewish friends in Israel, if you like, you know, our existence, if you like us to continue to over there in the Middle East, you have to completely change your policies and your way of behaving toward criminal policies of my government. If you want us to still exist, you have to change the way you react and to change the way you completely blindly support what my government is doing.
We've been speaking with three activists on the Israeli-Palestinian struggle. Yonathan Shapira from Combatants for Peace, his Palestinian brother, Bassam Aharonin, their partner in the organization Rebuilding Alliance, Donna Baranski-Walker. Donna, I wanted to ask you for your last thoughts.
It's really important to bring this case forward for people. I don't think most Americans realize how much power we have in this conflict. Our elected officials represent us, and when we ask our elected officials to call the Israeli embassy, they're the ones who get an answer. So our next step, as soon as we have the files translated, we'll be presenting a concise summary, and we ask people to pick up their phone, make those calls to seniors at their elected official level, and then let's see what we can do together.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Yonathan, Bassam, Donna.
Thank you.
You're in the struggle, and we're there with you. Thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder. Thank you.
Thank you.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. That's lawanddisorder.org.